The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Yes, and I am your host, Soraya, as always, here on Where Did the Road Go? And before we get to tonight's guest, we have some very interesting stuff coming up in the next few weeks. And next week we're doing a show on H.P. Lovecraft and his effect on culture. We have Penny Sartori the week after that on near-death experiences. Nick Redfern coming back. We have the Ghost Hunters of the Finger Lakes. We also have upcoming David Politis, Edmund Marriage at some point in the next couple of months, and many, many more. And we're going to be doing some more video bits. In a couple of weeks, we are going to go to the Para-Horror Convention up in Buffalo. And if you want to check out what that's all about, if you're in the local area, it's parahorror.com. There's also a banner for it on our website at wheredidtheroadgo.com. And one of the people there will be Lyle Blackburn. And we're going to be talking to Lyle and doing a video interview with him. There's a bunch of other reality TV, like paranormal people there from Ghost Hunters International and the like. So go to parahorror.com. There's also some people from various horror movies and stuff. It's kind of a mix of paranormal stuff and horror movie stuff. So we're going to be going to that. We're going to be doing some interviews and a segment on the fest itself. So look for that in a few weeks. We have some more personal stories of the paranormal we're going to be putting up, and maybe some other special stuff. Now, as for tonight, we have somebody who has some very interesting theories on how the Great Pyramid was built, among other things. His name is Stephen Myers. He's the author of Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid and the Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine. And are you with us, Steve?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me on your show.
Absolutely. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, excellent. It's just wonderful opportunity to be on shows like this to promote new ideas for people to hear.
All right. And where are you based out of?
We're in southwestern Oregon, in a beautiful small town.
Nice, nice. All right. So what got you interested in Egypt in the first place?
Well, I've always been interested in ancient technology, like antique gasoline engines. I've interested in the technology of World War II. Instead of like the generals and that type of thing, I was interested in ships and planes and all of that. So ultimately, if you like old technology and also history, then pretty soon your focus is going to become on the Great Pyramid, because it's a technological wonder that was built in very ancient times. So that's why I became interested in the Great Pyramid.
Okay, all right. And you want to talk a little about your first book, The Lost Technology of the Great Pyramid?
Yes, I was interested in not necessarily who built it, but how it was built. That was more interesting to me, how the stones were cut to extreme precision and how the thing was assembled. So I read all of these books by Egyptologists, and they have a story to tell about a big ramp and workers with strong backs that drug these stones around, and people with hand chisels doing the extreme stone cutting. But I discovered something that their books never told me. Took a lot of research to discover this very fascinating fact about Egyptology. And that fact is they have never moved one of the stones, the largest stones, a weight that large, 70 tons. The entire science has never moved one inch. Even though they say they know how it was done. And like casing stones, the stones that were on the outside of the Great Pyramid that were cut with extreme precision, all their books talk about how these stones were cut using hand tools and chisels and stuff. But Egyptology has never made a single casing stone in the entire existence of Egyptology. They have never made one surface of one casing stone at all. So they are a science that does not engage in the scientific method. So then I come to understand that Egyptology has a lot of issues, a lot of problems with what what they are saying and doing, mainly because they do not engage in the scientific method. So I looked at alternative books. Some books say that the Great Pyramid was a like a weapon, or that the Great Pyramid was some type of a machine, or that type of thing. And I was more in tune with this huge structure as serving some sort of a purpose instead of just being a tomb for a dead guy. And then ultimately, through decades of research, I ended up writing a book about how the Great Pyramid was built. And we think it was built using water locks and barges. And there's a video series that you can watch on our website, which is at thepump.org, that shows how water locks and barges were used to assemble the Great Pyramid all the way up to the capstone. And that's what my book is about.
Okay. And you want to get into a little bit of how they did this?
Yes. Water locks, similar to those in the Erie Canal or the Panama Canal, were from the Nile River all the way up to the building site. And the first stones that were set in place were the first layer of casing stones. So those were set in place, and it made like a square wall where the Great Pyramid is. And that area was filled with water. It impounded a square lake, if you will. So stones on barges would go from the Nile River all the way up the water locks into that square pond, and then they would put the stones, the interior stones, directly into that pond. And ultimately, when they fill that pond full of stones, the first layer of the Great Pyramid was assembled. And that process continued layer by layer, level by level, using water locks to construct the entire structure of the Great Pyramid.
Okay, and on the video series, you actually have animations and stuff to show how some of this would work.
Yes, they are about 14 10-minute videos, and with quite a bit of animation that is that's available to watch for free from our website at thepump.org. And I invite people to watch that, and it's really generated quite a bit of interest on this alternative explanation of how the Great Pyramid was assembled.
Okay. Now, I guess my first question would be, how do you think they cut the stones?
Okay. That is actually a mystery. I do not know how they were cut.
Okay.
But
okay,
my understanding that I do not know how they were cut is superior to Egyptology's explanation in all of their books that people with hand tools chiseled these stones. And that is
right.
A falsehood. That's incorrect. It's undemonstrable. It cannot be done.
And you got people like Christopher Dunn who have shown they were chiseled with something that wasn't or were cut with something that wasn't simply a chisel or something else. He shows evidence of high technology on a lot of these blocks.
Absolutely. Christopher Dunn has done a marvelous work on explaining the precision of these stones that were cut in the Great Pyramid, and many of them are beyond the scope of doing it by hand. It simply can't be done. And I can't believe here in the 21st century, even in college level classes, Egyptology can still say, oh yeah, they just did it with hand tools. Well, you know, can you demonstrate it? No, we don't do that. We're a science, we don't do demonstrations. And it's just bizarre. How did they get away with it?
Over the years, many people have tried to build some kind of replica of the Big Pyramid. Even small ones they've had trouble with using, you know, a tenth of the size.
Yes, that's true. A lot of demonstrations that are on TV documentaries that we've all watched, they show people dragging these stones, showing how they were moved. But they only drag stones that weigh like a ton and a half. mm-hmm. when virtually the smallest stones of the Great Pyramid are 2.5 tons and the largest are 70 tons. So it's disingenuous or a bait and switch to say that they can move massive stones by showing how they can move little stones. There's an issue of scale. That's like me saying, I can pick up a car. I can just go grab a car and pick it up. Well, I'll demonstrate it by picking up a matchbox car. I mean, it's not, you know, Egyptology is in crisis in terms of a lot of alternative researchers. And, you know, it's just stories that they tell in classrooms to students that ultimately become Egyptologists and tell the same stories. And that's not a science.
Okay. Well, once they do have the blocks cut, how do you propose they're getting them onto these barges?
I think that they used specialized equipment, some specialized barges that were used to raise and lower the stones onto the barges. For example, they could have a stone supported by other stones in the quarry and then have a barge go between the two stones that support it. That's the barge is halfway full of water, so it's low in the water, and then they would remove the water from the barge, and it would raise up and then lift the stone onto the barge. That whole process is probably better described in our video series with our computer-generated animations, and I think that they had specialized barges to move stones in various applications.
Right. Yeah. And I watched, I think I watched almost all, I think I was up to the last part of your video series. And, as far as putting them out, it's very plausible. It totally could work as far as I can tell. I guess my question is, how would they even get the blocks up in the first place? Like, would they have to run another canal next to where they were making the blocks, carving the blocks out?
Yes, that's in the quarry operation. My book simply focuses on the assembly of the Great Pyramid, not on the quarrying. But similar stone-moving techniques would be used in the quarrying application as were used in the assembly application. And the video series shows quite a bit of it, and there's certainly more detailed information in my book, Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid.
All right. Now, you're saying that they've made an enclosure around the Great Pyramid and filled that with water, and that's what the barges came into, and then they went through a series of locks, and as the thing grew in size, the locks would go higher and higher, and then they made the outlying part of the pyramid first.
Yeah, level by level, yes. Each level, they would put the casing stones on first, the outside stones, and they were cemented together watertight. The few that remain at the Great Pyramid are still cemented together watertight, and that created an enclosure that they would fill with water so barges could go right to the location for each stone and move the stone from the barge into the pond.
Okay. Is there any evidence of these walls and locks in the pyramid?
There's quite a bit of evidence for water and the Great Pyramid being in association with one another. There are no working water locks on the side of the Great Pyramid right now. We feel that those water locks were removed when they were not needed after the construction was finished. But Flanders Petrie found sediment inside the Great Pyramid. Mm-hmm. And also Herodotus, the 5th century BC historian, described the Great Pyramid as being like a island surrounded by water. And we think that there was a wall around the Great Pyramid and that water was possibly still in there as late as the 5th century BC. So it's interesting. He also talks a lot about canals in the area and that type of thing. So actually in the real world, moving heavy stones or payloads has been accomplished using water locks more so than all the other alternative ideas. You know, they're like anti-gravity devices or anything like that. Nothing has been demonstrated, but water locks have been. In the 1830s, they built the Erie Canal. It was 4.5 feet deep, but the barges could handle a payload of 70 tons.
Okay. Well, I would say the only person that has ever demonstrated a way they may have moved them, but we don't know exactly what he did, is the guy who built the Coral Castle.
Yes.
I can't remember his last name.
Yeah, Ed Liebenstrom or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, that's a mystery. He certainly did something there in Florida, but he made a point of not demonstrating what he did.
I mean, we know he did it. It wasn't a hoax because he was moving these giant blocks by himself. But unfortunately, he didn't tell anyone what he did.
Yeah, it's a modern day miracle, and I think that that should be studied and found out exactly what he did. It's very important for national security issues. Maybe some technology that he had developed would help us get off of oil. So. I think a huge budget, the size of the United States military budget, should be invested in finding out what Ed did, because if we find out and can utilize it, his technology, to move heavy payloads without using oil, then that would be that would help our national security.
Because he was one of the few people who claimed that he had discovered the secret of how they built the Great Pyramid. And could demonstrate it, but there it died with them.
Yeah, that's true, and it's unfortunate. But the ancient builders, they also were able to move those massive stones on a production line efficiency, like a stone every few minutes they were able to set in place on average. So it's a remarkable task, and the Erie Canal, again, that was built in the 1830s. It moved the weight of the Great Pyramid in a time span of 2 years. So water locks are fast, and they are efficient and powerful. The Panama Canal, here in the 21st century, they are adding additional water locks. So for bigger ships, so water locks are the system of choice here in the 21st century to move our largest objects. But I think that in the time of the Great Pyramid was built, water locks were the system of choice to be able to move their largest objects.
And now, as you've already said, 2.5 stones for the casing stones, right?
Actually, the casing stones were about 14 tons. They were large and extremely precisely cut and cemented together. The interior stones, the vast majority, were rough cut and about 2.5 tons. And a few dozen stones were in the 50 to 70 ton range.
Now, how would they move those? Would they still be able to use the same system? Would they have to make different barges to move such big stones?
Yes, they would probably have specialized barges for each task. And our video series shows how smaller stones were used as well, were moved as well as larger stones. And they just utilized the force of buoyancy and barges to move heavy payloads. People in the 1830s that lived around the Erie Canal, they knew you could move 70-ton payloads in a canal 4.5 feet deep. But we're kind of in the 21st century, and people know about their cell phones, but they have kind of forgotten this type of technology.
Okay. Do we have any evidence of these barges? Like, have we found anything that supports this?
There's no evidence of any barges that were used to build the Great Pyramid. There's no hieroglyphs. There's no writings. There's no artifacts of any barges. There are some hieroglyphs showing the movement of obelisks that are quite heavy using barges and large ships. And also, there's no evidence at all for a massive ramp to build the Great Pyramid.
Right, right.
You know what I'm trying to say?
Oh, yeah, so, yeah. But I would think you would need that smoking gun to really convince people, like, for us to dig up a barge or something. We've dug up some sun ships around, which you think were used as levers, basically,
yes,
right?
Yes, as large floating levers, in effect, to lift the smaller stones off the barges and set them into that pond I was talking about. That, you know, the sun barges are evidence. Different people have an explanation for the evidence. Certainly Egyptologists say, oh, it had some symbolic meaning, or it was used to move the king's carcass to the Great Pyramid or whatever. I say that it had a functional purpose used to build this massive structure in the Valley of the Nile.
And is there evidence on these things that they were used that way?
Well, they are built to be taken apart. And we think that the purpose that they were built to be disassembled, kind of like a kit, if you will, was that when the process of using them became finished, the pond was pretty high in the construction process, and they disassembled those boats and took the parts down through the water locks. That is an explanation for the evidence of those boats. Also, they are certainly strangely built. I don't know if they're exactly seaworthy, but they would be effective to use as a pivoting lever, a floating lever that's described in our video series at thepump.org. So people can look at our explanation of this same evidence that everyone else has and come to their own conclusions.
Okay, what about when they get near the top where there's not enough room necessarily to fit a barge in there?
Right. On the top layers of the Great Pyramid, the stones start to become smaller, and we think that they could have used smaller boat cranes. There's several other boat pits around the Great Pyramid that are smaller than the two sun barges that they found. So we feel that there's a possibility that they could have used smaller barges for that application. And also the pond gets smaller as you go up. And in our video series, it shows that an enclosure wall was built and the process was able to continue until a capstone was put on. And that's depicted very well with computer-generated animation in our video series.
All right, okay. So, short of a smoking gun, it's a very solid theory.
Well, everyone has their own thoughts, but I think that it is very solid with at the structure as a technical, in a technical way. It's a 45-story skyscraper that was built in ancient times. And, you know, it doesn't matter what language they spoke, what gods they worshipped, or who their king was, or if they were slaves or not. None of that matters in terms of a technical explanation of how the stones were assembled to build that structure. So, yeah, a lot of people are really, really like this theory. I mean, they haven't been embracing it. The interest has been very high. I've been writing just a number of articles for magazines and doing a number of interviews. So, people really respond to it instead of having a whole bunch of guys on a big ramp that would have to be bigger than the Great Pyramid dragging stones, that can't be demonstrated. So,
nor is what you're doing calling for any kind of exotic technology.
That's true. There's that. That's an issue as opposed to I've heard ideas about anti-gravity bubbles, even anti-gravity butterfly wings was suggested, or must have been aliens that used a magic wand. You know, none of that. But real people in the real world really did build the Great Pyramid, And we have a kind of a common sense solution to one of the mysteries of the ages on how that massive structure was built. And we think that there's a lot of evidence of the Great Pyramid that supports this explanation.
Okay. Do you want to give some examples of that?
Oh, yeah. That the casing stones were cemented together watertight. The cement, or the bonding agent is a better way to call it, was stronger than the stone itself. And that's not to keep the pesky Egyptian rain out, because they don't have any rain. The reason why they were cemented together watertight was to keep the water in during construction. And just a whole host of other things. On the some of the casing stones on the outside that are on the south side of the Great Pyramid, looks like they have been eroded with water erosion, because there was an enclosure wall around the Great Pyramid up until about the 17th century. And there's just the sediment, the explanation of Herodotus, and just a whole host of interpretations of that evidence based on this water theory that people seem to respond to.
Yeah, well, I know one of the explanations of the water is that the pyramid is much older and was there at the time of the flood at the end of the last ice age.
Yes, either the ice age or the biblical flood. Yes, I don't address the age of the Great Pyramid, but it's easy to find out who did and who didn't build the Great Pyramid. Egyptologists know a whole bunch about ancient Egypt. Well, why can't they know about the ancient Egyptian civilization, but that ancient Egyptian civilization can't seem to be able to make a casing stone? I mean, it's a remarkable task to make stones that are cut that large and that precise, because Egyptologists can't do it, and they're the experts. So possibly the age of the Great Pyramid may be quite a bit older than Egyptologists tell us.
Now, what about the other two pyramids on Giza?
The other two pyramids on Giza are actually beyond the scope of my research.
Okay. All right.
We actually concentrate just on how the Great Pyramid, how that structure was assembled and why it was assembled. But there are we do talk about the other two. The assembly process could have been similar to that of the Great Pyramid, but their exact purpose is still under scholarly debate.
Okay. Do you think that there are any other pyramids that were built like this, like anywhere in the world? Or
That's an excellent question. It's hard to say. I don't think that any of the other pyramids on the Earth were built in this manner. Even the two larger pyramids on the Giza Plateau may not have been built by the same culture that built the Great Pyramid. That's not a given. They could have been built by different people, different centuries, different civilizations. A lot of the pyramids in Mexico and South America and Central America are built with a lot smaller stones, rubble, if you will. So mm-hmm. It's quite a bit different. It, you know, there's a lot of differences, but this Great Pyramid seems to be unique among all pyramids in the world.
So why do you think they would have developed this technology just to build one structure?
Oh, that's easy. That's easy. Thank you for asking me that question. That's the same reason why they only built one Aswan Dam.
Okay.
That's all they needed. But the biggest structure in Africa, the biggest structure in the Nile Valley, is the Aswan High Dam. And it was built to do one thing, and that is make electricity. And the use of that electricity, much of it, is to irrigate. So the High Aswan Dam is the centerpiece of a large irrigation system, a large water pump, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The largest structure in North America is the Grand Coulee Dam, the largest thing ever built in North America. And when it was built, it was the most expensive thing ever built in North America. And it is on the Columbia River in Washington. And it does two things. Its first and primary purpose is to pump water for irrigation. And it also generates a lot of electricity. And in the Valley of the Nile in ancient times, I think the people that built the Great Pyramid created infrastructure, this large infrastructure associated with a large river. And that Great Pyramid in Egypt, its purpose was to function as a machine. And what that machine did was that it pumped water.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in about a minute. And when we come back, you can tell us exactly how that would have worked. We're talking to Stephen Myers. We'll be right back on Where Did the Road Go?
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we are talking with Stephen Myers here tonight about his two books, Lost Technology of the Great Pyramid and The Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine. And I guess we're pretty much up to that second book now, huh, Stephen?
Yes, we are. I think The Great Pyramid, as the title of my book indicates, was a prosperity machine. It wasn't built for any type of religious purpose. It wasn't built for any type of symbolic purpose. And it wasn't built to tell us something. And it wasn't built to commemorate anything, but that it was a functional machine. It served a purpose, just like the highway system serves a purpose, just like a hammer serves a purpose. And it was built with a purpose in mind, and that purpose is to pump water. And when you can control water in a large desert area, you have prosperity. The Great Pyramid changed the desert into a garden. It changed poverty into prosperity, and it changed work into leisure. And that's what the Great Pyramid was built for.
All right. And how did it work?
Okay. The Great Pyramid, before it was even built, they constructed a large room. They excavated, if you will, into solid bedrock below the Great Pyramid, a large room, and associated cuttings. And that large room, the subterranean chamber, was used similar to a hydraulic ram water pump, only we feel that it was much more sophisticated than a hydraulic ram water pump. And ultimately, that those cuttings in the solid bedrock allowed water to supply, to fill those ponds I kept talking about, and to supply the water for the water locks. So that lower pump down there, excuse me, helped supply the water to build the Great Pyramid. And then the Great Pyramid, which doesn't look like a tomb inside, because it has all kinds of passages and chambers that Egyptology gives convoluted explanations for, those passages and chambers have a functional purpose with sliding stones and that are actually valves that ultimately pump water. And the output of the Great Pyramid was the King's Chamber's vents, and the input was the descending passage. And they used the Great Pyramid to pump water. And it's described, it's very technical, and it's described in my second book to great detail. So that's what they did.
Okay, and I assume the source of the water would have been the Nile.
Yes, actually, there's a scholarly debate about that. Some say the Nile. Others say the ancient Lake Maurice, which is still in Egypt. It's much smaller now. But Herodotus talks about canals and that type of thing. But ultimately, from the Nile, ultimately, if you will. But yes. And then they pumped the water. Certainly, the one purpose was irrigation. But also, they used the water, I feel, to power machinery for experimental purposes, to create compressed air, and also to create vacuum. And those things are very valuable for scientific experiments. With compressed air, you can make a very hot area, if you will, and a very cold area using other apparatus. So I see the Giza Plateau as more of an industrial park and a science center than a graveyard.
Okay. Yeah, well, there's never been any evidence that they were tombs. I mean, they just, Egyptologists kind of just made that assumption and made it dogma.
That's true. They just kept telling the story. Egyptology actually was born from early explorers, adventurers, and tomb robbers. And if you're a tomb robber and you see this great big structure, you're going to say, wow, I'm going to go rob that thing, and it must be a tomb. And then you find out that it supposedly, because there's no evidence that it was for a funeral, that means that somebody must have stole it before the artifacts before the Egyptologists could steal it. So anyway, it's just a story they tell.
Not only that, but there was no way into the structure. And when they got in, it was empty.
That's correct. Yes, when it was finally breached, yes. Also, a good question is, how do long open passages that have sliding stones, how does that protect the pharaoh's mummy?
Yeah.
There's no answer for that.
And, you know, I look at the way that we got into the pyramid by blowing a hole in the side of it, and I just think that, you know, you're looking at, like, very dull children trying to deal with high technology and not even understanding that that's what they're dealing with, and they're just breaking it.
I agree with you fully. You are correct.
You know, we don't look at anything in the ancient world that it could be high technology. We assume it was primitive and probably for religious use.
Yeah, that's an easy cop-out, just to say you find some relic or artifact, an out-of-place artifact, if you will, and say, that's symbolic, religious, or some societal thing, instead of saying, well, it was a sophisticated mechanism or whatever. So, and Egyptologists are famous for saying those things, like the Baghdad Battery. I don't think Egyptologists even acknowledge yet that it could possibly be used to make electricity, even though real scientists actually demonstrated that it can. So
right.
I think the Great Pyramid is, in effect, an out-of-place artifact, that the only thing that is really out of place is our understanding of very ancient times is what's out of place, not the Great Pyramid.
So they would be using this for irrigation, is the farming for the irrigation that this is going to feed, is this going to be right around the pyramid, or how far out would this reach?
Again, that's under scholarly debate, but quite a bit. I know the Nile, before the Aswan Dam was built, had a yearly inundation, but in modern times, they ended that yearly inundation, but built the dam to be the center of a irrigation project. But the Great Pyramid doesn't stop the yearly inundation, but it still allowed for irrigation instead of just a one-time irrigation for year-round. So I don't know the acreage exactly that it would irrigate, but it would be substantial. The vents, okay. The King's Chamber vents are about 8 inches square, and they would move a tremendous volume of water.
Now, is there any evidence of farming around the Great Pyramid?
Yes, there right around the Great Pyramid, there's villages that have been there traditionally, and that type of thing. Certainly, there are workers' camps that people like Egyptologists say, were from the workers who built the Great Pyramid, that type of thing. So yes, people lived in that area around, you know, that ancient structure.
Okay. All right. What are, any thoughts on the Sphinx, its age, Robert Schock's work, anything like that?
Yes. Robert Schock, who I was honored to be in a TV documentary with, he about the Great Pyramid, but, you know, he's an idol to, you know, I'm in awe of him, a tremendous individual and very, very humble. And but his water-related erosion with the with the Sphinx indicates that it was older. But with our research about water related to the Great Pyramid, and the Sphinx is actually downhill from the Great Pyramid, there could have been some associated erosion with the Great Pyramid water pump and the output eroding some of the Sphinx. So it's interesting. All of that is very interesting.
Well, I know also he specifically says that some of the erosion is due to rainfall because of the way it erodes.
Yes, yes, that's true. And I agree with that because I also, although I don't focus on the age of the Great Pyramid, because that can never be really resolved. You know, you can just discuss it. It's not going to help anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not going to change anything. But I do feel that the Great Pyramid was built in a lot older than Egyptologists say. It, just 40 years ago, it was a given that the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid were built within a generation or two. And now, a lot of people, because of Robert Schock, feel that the Sphinx was much older. But the possibility is that the Great Pyramid could be as old as the Sphinx.
Okay. With your method, how long would it have taken to build the pyramid?
Well, I have various ideas, but I usually say about 7 years.
Really?
Yeah, and people say, really? Oh, well, it takes 2 minutes. You have to place a stone every 2 minutes, and it takes 20 years. That's if you only do a 10-hour day. But water locks the world over always operate 24 hours a day. So most of the work, except for the precision stone placement, could have been done 24 hours a day. Just like factories today are run 24 hours a day. So with that in mind, and the barges could handle maybe about 5 stones, and you could probably fill a water lock in 5 minutes. So, and if you figure that 24 hours a day, it makes a good number, 7 years. So, you know, the Grand Coulee Dam, of course, this is all completely different, but it's about 13 times the volume of the Great Pyramid, and it was built in it's surprisingly how short the time span was to build it. So,
now the Coulee Dam, is that the one that has the star chart on it as well?
I think that's the Hoover Dam.
Okay,
and that
yes,
recently
it is the Hoover Dam.
Was set in place. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Not original.
What was I just going to ask you? Oh, what was the bonding agent you think was used for the casing stones?
Oh, there's controversy about that because the scientific method has not been used to recreate that bonding agent. Egyptologists say, oh, it was mortar or plaster, and you use this wet plaster and it makes it easier to slide the stones one on top of another. But mortar and plaster aren't stronger than the stone itself. So it's just like everything else about the Great Pyramid, there's great controversy about it. But I think that the geniuses who built the Great Pyramid were able to develop a very strong bonding agent that is a lost technology of the Great Pyramid. And that, I think, if that could be redeveloped, then it would be valuable in our modern day.
Now, don't Egyptologists point to a text that says how long it took to build the Great Pyramid?
you know, I can't speak for them. They can come up with like a little scrap of papyrus with some little lines on it or whatever, but there's no formal hieroglyphs inside the Great Pyramid.
Right, yeah. I thought it was something else somewhere that had listed that it took like 25 years to build or something.
Well, yeah. They bait and switch a lot. They'll find something that was done, let's say, a temple that was built at least 2,000 years after the Great Pyramid, and then say, well, see, this hieroglyph on this temple shows these people with mallets hitting a rock. So that's how they made stones cut to extreme precision. Well, that's a hypothesis. But if you the next step is to use that hypothesis and demonstrate it and make a casing stone, then there isn't any controversy because you've engaged in the scientific method. But Egyptology won't do that. They won't put their money where their mouth is, or whatever you want to call it. They will not engage in the scientific method. It's bizarre.
Why do you think Egyptology is the way it is at this point?
I think that it has become kind of a mystery religion, if you will, that they are just Egyptologists or more like high priests that initiate the students or whatever you want to call them, and then they just retell the same stories. But people are tired of that. People don't agree with it. I don't even know anyone that's past the sixth grade that believes that the precision cut stones were made by hand. I mean, yet they still do it. There's no controversy about the various hardness of rocks, because people demonstrate that. There's no controversy about how in colonial times they built furniture or made books, because there's museums, what they call living museums, where they make books like they did in colonial times, where they make furniture like they did. There's no controversy about any of that. There's no controversy really about how they make Damascus steel, because people do that. You know, in ancient times, they made Damascus steel, that very strong steel with the stripes in it, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, there are people that actually get out there, break a sweat, and recreate these artifacts that look like the originals. So then they make a conclusion. Well, how these newer ones were made is very similar to how the originals were made, because they actually, you know, but Egyptology just doesn't do it. It's just, there was another, sciences through the course of time come and they go. One science was called phrenology, which talked about the bumps on people's heads and how they relate to mental conditions and personality. And that was phrenology. We've all seen those busts that have the lines on the skull about different personality traits and everything. But that there was only one problem with that science, and that is it couldn't withstand the rigors of the scientific method. And it has gone, you know, to the waste bin. Egyptology is in a very similar position. People just aren't, you know, just don't believe that anymore. They don't believe a ramp was built that was bigger than the volume of the Great Pyramid to drag these stones up this. I mean, it's just a story they've come up with. But if people still buy books or take college classes, I mean, it'll still be taught, you know, as long as there's money in it, I guess. But it's detrimental to understanding the truth.
What do you think it's going to take for them to change their views on this?
Well, I think what it's going to take is time. They're just going to have to die off. They found, no, I mean that seriously.
No, I know.
There was an artifact called the Piltdown Skull. And as soon as they found it, the greatest minds in anthropology, oh, yeah, that's the missing link. But believe it or not, there were file marks on the skull and jawbone to make the two fit. The greatest experts couldn't figure it out. And it was only 40 years later that a new generation of experts said, well, the Piltdown Skull, it's not really real. It's kind of fake. But no, the first group they never changed their mind. They died off. And the second group, they never changed their mind. They all already initially understood that the Piltdown skull was false. And that's what's going to happen. All these Egyptologists need, you know, it's going to take some time, another 40 years, for them to be replaced by people that are seeking an understanding with a greater truth. So, you know, it's like I say, they are detrimental to understanding our mankind's ancient past.
Now, Christopher Dunn believes that the Great Pyramid was a was also a power plant, but not necessarily a water pump per se. How do your ideas differ?
Well, he feels that it was some sort of a machine that used, believe it or not, hydrogen and also some microwave energy. I'm not trying to speak for him. I suggest people read his book. You know, there's nothing more more revolutionary than asking someone to read a book. So, but read it and see what he says. But I also think that it was a machine, but that it and it used hydrogen in part of it, but it was used as a water pump, and instead of his microwave energy and all of that. So I'm not trying to say that we're closer than we are farther apart. Let me put it that way. He also has a disdain for traditional Egyptology. And he addresses this ancient technological wonder in a technological way. So, he wants to understand how the components were made, as opposed to understanding hieroglyphs or king's lists or all of that. He's not into that.
Right.
So I have an affinity to Christopher Dunn and that type of thing. So. If people want to find out more, read his books and hopefully read my books.
Any thoughts to the tunnels that run underneath Giza?
There are reports, just we've all heard them, on Facebook and the forums about mysterious tunnels, a network of tunnels, and even the Hall of Records under the Sphinx and other things. Certainly... no photographs have surfaced, but there are tunnels. There are some tunnels that are less well-known, less documented, that go all over the place, various explanations for them. Be a good way to transport water for, that's one explanation. So, it's a lot different than than what Egyptologists tell you about sweaty guys with strong backs and all of that. You know, ancient mankind was very sophisticated, very intelligent, and there's a lot of ancient technologies that they had that I think would help us in our modern but very troubled world.
True. And it seems that there was a peak of technology, and we went down from there further and further into the Dark Ages, where we just lost all of it.
I believe that that's correct. I very much, catastrophism is what that's called, where civilizations end because of some sort of catastrophe. Could be the biblical flood, could be the Ice Age, or other political or even medical, like the Ebola virus or whatever could disrupt a civilization. And so it's very fascinating information, and the books, my books, are quite detailed on a technical level about this technical marvel.
Okay, what do you think about like the alignment theories?
There's a lot of there's a lot of alignment theories. I believe you're referring to the Orion correlation theory, where the vents
and Andrew Collins Cygnus correlation as well.
Oh yes, yeah. There's various vents. The vents actually don't point to those stars.
Okay.
They say they do, but if you turn back the sky, the stars move across the sky over the eons, and then if you pick a date, then those stars will line up to the vents. But what feature of the Great Pyramid indicates that that correlation was supposed to be significant?
Well, I think Bovall and Hancock, with the Orion correlation, were also lining up the Sphinx with Leo rising on the horizon that particular year as well.
Right.
So that everything kind of lined up at the same time.
Yeah.
But I don't think they weren't as concerned with the vents as just the layout of Giza, the way it matched Orion and the Sphinx matched Leo all at the same time, about 10,500 BC.
Yeah. Everything aligns with everything else. There is a correlation between pirates and global warming. Okay? hear me out. There was very few pirates in the 1600s, or excuse me, there was a lot of pirates in the 1600s, but very little global warming. But now there's very few pirates and a lot of global warming. So it's an inverse proportional relationship. And there's web pages, Wikipedia pages about this, but it's a correlation that does not have causation. And that's, I'm not debating that something lines up with something. But I'm just wonder about the causation. You know, what was the was that the real intent of the original builders?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what's up for debate. The Statue of Liberty has seven spikes in its crown. All seven of those spikes point to stars. Anything that points up points to stars. But is there a correlation? The Empire State Building in New York, the top of it points up to a star. Was that the intent of the original builders, even though there is a star alignment?
Well, I think with Graham, too, though, he's also found alignments like at Angkor Wat and stuff at the same time period that line up with Scorpio and other star formations. So,
I get your
point. You're saying correlation isn't causation necessarily.
That's correct. Now, let me just say this. 100 years ago, there was a whole different set of correlations and alignments. Those had to do with the Great Pyramid and the Bible. And that was called pyramidology, or what I call biblical correlation theory. But people went to their graves believing that the Great Pyramid was the Bible in stone, and all of these are real correlations that really correlated, that predicted the birthplace of Jesus and a whole host of other things using the pyramid inch and, you know, crunching the numbers and all of that. So why would one set of correlations that actually correlate be valid and the other set not valid?
And that was what, moving up the Grand Gallery, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yeah, with the pyramid inch, each inch was like a year type of thing. And then a feature of the Great Pyramid would indicate, like, World War One. Hey,
right,
there was a correlation. Or, the Exodus from Egypt by the Jews. There was, you know, and then, I mean, it went on for forever. And it was very popular in even up until the 1920s. But those are...
I think there are still people who believe it today,
yes,
honestly.
Yes, there are. But the point is, that is one set of correlations. What are those correlations valid as well as the Orion correlations? Or is one of them... more valid than the other, or are neither set of correlations valid?
Well, I think the difference between those correlations is the Grand Gallery one is predictive, whereas Hancock and Bovall argue that the correlation with Orion marks the first time, Zeptepe, in Egyptian culture, which was 10,500 BC.
Correlation is a correlation. If it lines up, it's a correlation. But again, it's causation that's the issue. You know, that's what we need to find out. Did the original builders intend for these correlations? Because everything correlates to something and everything lines up to something, no matter what.
That is true.
We just have to find out the intent of the original builders.
Your two books, once again, are The Lost Technology of the Great Pyramid and The Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine. These can be picked up on Amazon and everywhere else.
Everywhere else. And if the bookstore doesn't have it, they can order it, or they're both available as Kindle ebooks.
Okay. And your websites are what?
The website is thepump.org. That's the Great Pyramid is a pump, and so you just go to thepump.org. We have a 501c3 nonprofit foundation that we're currently trying to fund the purchase of a 3D printer to help build this ancient water pump and demonstrate how the Great Pyramid could operate as a water pump. So if you're interested in being involved in our fundraising effort, just go to thepump.org.
All right. Well, I thank you very much, Stephen. This has been fascinating. And I highly recommend people check out your stuff. And your, as we've already talked about, your video series has some animations, which might make this a lot clearer for people, or they can pick up the books.
Well, thank you so much, and I really appreciate you having me on your program.
All right. We're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation. Last Exit for the Lost is up next. Here's Whirring World.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Of the universe, ventricles and tetrahead, chambers number 1597, and counting. Can you?